So, here we are. It's quite a profound statement to say casually, here we are. Because here is where it is. Here's where the practice unfolds. Here's where your life unfolds. Here's where reality shows up for you, is here. And often the mind is not here and now, but the mind is there and then. And the task practice is to be here and now. So even if you're thinking about there and then, you're completely cognizant that this is happening here and now. So you don't have necessarily have to reject there and then, the thoughts about those, but it's you can be aware, you can possibly be aware of the mind thinking about the past, memories, or planning the future, and do it with such luminosity, such clarity, that, you know, you're just really know that you're here. You know that you're here. You know that you know that you're thinking. And it's a beautiful thing to have such clarity in your knowing that you could. You don't go around think this way. You'll tie yourself in knots, perhaps, if you do too much of this. But you know that you know. You know you're present. It's so obvious. Wow. I'm here, and I know I'm here. And it's a beautiful thing to have that strength of attention, because when attention gets that strong, it's possible to feel, to know, to experience a presence, a way of being that doesn't have to reject anything. There's nothing to reject, it's just something to hold in that field of knowing, that field of awareness, that field of presence. And it's safe to do it because in that strong field of presence, a strong field of attention, you're not going to be fooled by anything that you're aware of, fooled into reacting, responding, attacking, blaming, identifying with it, rejecting anything. So all the kind of movements of the mind and the heart that cause suffering. The stronger the presence is, the less likely you care about that. Doing that kind of stuff is going to pale in importance. Or if you do that, it's okay, because you have this bigger container. The analogy I like to use is if you go into an elevator, a small elevator, that maybe a room for two people, but there's three really big, humongous slobs. They have ketchup down their shirts. They haven't showered for weeks. And you have to squeeze in between these three big people. And you kind of feels claustrophobic. It doesn't feel good to be in there. But then the doors open up to this huge, beautiful cathedral. Big vaulted ceilings and space, and all these people, those three people, kind of spread out across this huge, big, wonderful space. And you're in one corner of the room; they're way over there. And then, you know, then it's easy to love humanity. Goodwill, compassion for them, but in that elevator, you know, ketchup, you know, and their stink, you know, you have to really work at the love. There's the mind gets claustrophobic, the mind gets tight, and we're so concerned with our thoughts and our preoccupations and our feelings and our emotions, and every drama of the moment or every drama of all other moments in time are so important. We invest so much, there's so much authority we give our past, our future, our thoughts, our identities. So much authority we give to what we think about ourselves, and all this stuff. It gets claustrophobic. And the poor mind, you know, will feel like, you know, get this ketchup off me, you know, get this, you know, get, you know, it's and what the practice can do is give breathing room for your mind to create space and more space, like a cathedral. And that's a very different paradigm, very different approach to how normal people try to, often people try to kind of deal with their issues of their life, where we're trying to fix and solve and push away or hide or explain away or rather than doing any of that, it's like make room for it. Open up to it. Make space for it. Let the mind become like a great vaulted cathedral, or if that image is okay for you. And just, you know, you have lots of room. You can love all of humanity. You can love all of yourself in that space. You can have the worst thought that any human being has ever had in the history of humanity. You could be that lucky. And in that, all that space, it's like, wow, you can feel it with love or care or just a certain kind of spaciousness. When it's claustrophobic and you have the worst thought, you don't even have the worst thought, you have a mildly bad thought. And in that claustrophobic little elevator, that mildly bad thought can just seem like so big and terrible, and I'm so bad, and whatever. So it's a different paradigm, it's a different, very different approach to kind of get open to what's there, but open to make space bigger, bigger. And in that bigger space of mind, bigger space of heart, I'm proposing that it's safe. You're safer that way, because in that, the more space you give, the less you're going to be tricked into investing a lot of the kind of importance where you get attached, where you cling, where you reject and push and do all these things. Things become simpler. And so you get to be yourself. One of the great gifts. You get to be yourself. And I'm sure that all of you are mixed bags. You know, I don't want to say here, you know, you're just like all these beautiful people and you're all great. It wouldn't actually do you a service to treat you as just embodiments, angelic quality, just all angels. And I'm sure you're mixed bags. And in spite of that, you're beautiful. Right? In spite of that, you can hold it in all this space. You can hold it a very different way. And it doesn't have to be a problem. There can be freedom with it all. So then I would propose something like that: the normal mind running around being busy is claustrophobic, so everything seems so important. But it's also kind of chaotic. There's a lot going on in there. And it is, mind is a big ecosystem. And one of the ways to begin making some sense of the chaos is these wonderful lists that Buddhism has. Some people say the lists are there to help us memorize better, to remember. But I think these wonderful lists are ways of understanding the different elements of our inner ecosystem. So we begin seeing what's there and teasing apart and start making space between the things that are there. And so one of the species of animals in your ecosystem is the six paramitas. And the six paramitas, or the six perfections, are the theme we're going to use for the talks on this retreat. And there's 6 days for talks, and there's six paramitas. That's very convenient. And today the topic is the first paramita, which is the paramita of dana, or generosity. Then we'll have, probably every day we should review what they are. So there's that. Then the second one is sila, or virtue, ethics, morality. And the third one is kshanti, which is usually translated as patience or acceptance. Sometimes they translate both words, patient acceptance. And then there is virya, which is sometimes translated as heroic effort. And then there's jhana, which in those of you in the Pali tradition will know that it's jhana, so samadhi, concentration. And the last one is wisdom, or insight, depending how you translate prajna, panya. And so many of the lists that have generosity in it begin with generosity. There's a great Zen story that I'm fond of by a Zen master, Chinese Zen master named, is it Wu Hai his name is pronounced? Wu Hai. It's a long time since I've, you know, given Zen teaching, so I'm a rusty. These names. So, someone asked this teacher in China, what's the gate of Zen? And he replied, complete giving. And one of the reasons I love this story is because a gate is something you go into and you go out of something. You can go both directions. And the question doesn't ask, what's the gate in? Or what's the gate out? Just, what's the gate? And so generosity is both a gate into practice, and when practice matures, I don't want to say the gate out, but it's with the maturation of practice, it's the way forward also, the gate back into the world. Zen, they talk about end of the practice, you go back into the world with gift-bestowing hands. You have something beautiful to offer the world when you become mature in your practice. So whether it's the beginning of practice or the end of practice, generosity is a wonderful practice, a wonderful part of it. I was slow to come to this idea of generosity. It, somehow growing up, it wasn't really like a thing that was taught to me. So much so that when I came to Zen Center, I worked first at the Tassajara Bakery, and there was the manager of the bakery was a man named Jay Simino, and I was up in the office doing. I worked down in the bakery, but I was up in the office with him one day. I don't know what I was doing there, and he opened a letter from a local neighborhood association, asking for a donation for some good neighborhood cause, and he read the letter to me and he said, I'm going to give them $50. In fact, 1979 was more than it is now. And I was kind of stunned. Why would he do that? So that doesn't speak well for me, but you know, why would he do that? So that kind of really got my attention. Wow, what's that about? And then when I was in Thailand, I went to do my. I kind of stumbled upon my first Vipassana retreat, and I was given a little hut at the edge of the monastery. The monastery was the edge of some swamps and rice fields, and so it was kind of the outskirts of the monastery. I was given this little one-room little hut on stilts, over kind of up out of the swamp, and there was a little porch and some steps going down to some planks of wood that went for, I don't know, maybe 40 feet or so across the swamp to the dry land. So in the morning, the monks of the monastery would go out on their alms rounds. They go with their bowls into the villages and collect food for the day. And then they would come back and offer that to give that to the kitchen. The kitchen would lay it out, and then at 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, we would all go into the dining room, and all that food was laid out, and we would eat the meal of the day from the food they had gathered in their alms rounds. But I was not a monk, so I didn't go on the alms rounds. So I stayed in my little one-room little hut. That's where I did all my practice for 10 weeks. And I was sitting there meditating in the morning. And it was time to end the morning meditation, I guess. And so I got up and I opened my door. And right in front of me was a little porch and steps and then that long plank of wood going out to the dry land. And I looked at the top of the steps in the porch, and there was an apple and some cookies. And then I looked, and my eyes went up, and to the far end of that plank, just before it went back up on the dry land, there was a monk who was walking away. So it was an act of generosity for me. But the thing that really touched me deeply, made a big impression on me, was that he did not know that I was going to open the door at that moment. he was giving me that the gift without any expectation or, I guess, desire to be recognized for what he was doing. It was an anonymous gift. And so being a little bit backward in things, in the generosity world, that made a big impression on me. That kind of freedom of giving without expecting anything in return. And that was my experience over and over again in Asia. Practicing in Asia was the degree to which the practice there occurred in a field of generosity and goodwill. I literally, when I was in Burma practicing, I felt that I was a guest of the country. And no money was ever asked of me. I practiced intensely in a monastery there for 8 months. And there was never any discussion or expectation that I would offer any money whatsoever for my time there in the monastery. I was fed, I was given a room, and any need, anything that was a need that I was needed was given, provided so I can keep practicing. And including some of the doctors in Rangoon, medical schools, would come to us in the monastery if we were sick. I remember I was sitting, meditating, minding my own business, very peacefully and quietly, I believe, doing nothing else but just, you know, minding my own business. And suddenly, my filling fell out. You're supposed to let go, right? But so I guess I let go in the wrong way. So that, boom, maybe the hot, cold there, maybe, I don't know what it was. So I told my teacher, and the next day, a dentist came to see me for free. So I felt this tremendous generosity. I don't know if it's a true story, but there's a story told in, an Englishman back in the English days when there's a colony, went into what he thought was a house. No, what he thought was a restaurant, and sat at a table, maybe in the porch or something, and people fed him, and he didn't realize he was at someone's private home until he asked for the bill. So these people he sat down, and people came out and they fed him. Isn't that nice? Amazing generosity of giving. Over and over again, that was the experience in Asia. So here's another giving story. When I was in Japan, I'd been ordained by the abbot of Zen Center, and then there was the kind of the fallout, the crisis, and he left Zen Center, and in some ways, then I was a Zen monk without a teacher, and so I went to Japan. That was kind of like how I was seen. That was kind of unusual in Japan to be a Zen monk without a teacher. And they had a term for that. You're called a ronin monk, because a ronin is a samurai without a master. So there was a certain etiquette about how people treat a ronin monk that I didn't know about. So this is how it worked. So I did a sesshin, a 7-day retreat, at a temple. And at the end of the 7 days, I was going to leave, so I had a meeting with the abbot, and to thank him for the time, and I was going to give him a little bit of, you know, dana, a little gift for money in exchange for having been there. And I didn't have a lot of money, but I had some, so I gave him. In Japan, you do it very formally. You put it in an envelope, and you hand it to him in this envelope. And so he received it graciously, and then we talked for a little bit, and it became obvious as we talked that I was a Ronin monk. So then he said, "Excuse me." And he went to the back room, and he came out with an envelope and handed me an envelope that had more money in it than I'd given him. Because what you do for a Ronin monk is you give them, in Japan, you give them train money, travel money, so they can go and keep looking. If it didn't work for you, if it didn't work for him to be my master, then he gives me money so I can go look for another one. Because it's important to have a master, a teacher. So, this wonderful thing. I gave him, and he gave me more back. And the whole experience of generosity and freely giving. And one of the consequences for me was that it was so clear that how much I was being supported by people in my practice that I really wanted to practice better, or I don't know if that's the right word. I wanted to just be more wholehearted, more dedicated, to take it seriously, not goof off in my practice, just really because, not for their sake, because kind of to be worthy of this generosity and gifts that people gave me. So the first of the paramitas is the perfection of generosity. It's kind of a big thing, you know, perfection and perfectionism. But it has a number of meanings, this idea of paramitas or parami. In the Mahayana tradition, as I understand it, one of the meanings of when you put the word perfection, paramita, before a quality like generosity, is that it's implied that it goes together with the last of the paramitas, which is the perfection of wisdom. And it's the perfection of wisdom that some of the understanding of bringing wisdom to bear on these different qualities that lets it become a perfection. But in some of these early Mahayana sutras, there's a beautiful quality, a beautiful way in which wisdom is understood, the perfection of wisdom is understood. The perfection of wisdom is not some great philosophical position or understanding. It doesn't take a PhD in Buddhism to understand it. It's not emptiness, which many people think, that somehow emptiness, maybe it's closely connected. But the way that the perfection of wisdom is sometimes defined or described, it's non-clinging. Or some texts it's called what's translated into English as non-appropriation, non-acquisition, non-acquisitiveness is probably a good word. So that's an unusual definition of wisdom. To not cling, to not be acquisitive, not to hold on and grasp. So what makes the perfection of generosity a perfection is when the generosity is done without any clinging as part of it, without any acquisitiveness as part of it. And you would think that's, you know, it doesn't make sense. Giving shouldn't have any acquisitiveness or greed as part of it. But often there's some kind of greed, some kind of something we're clinging to when we give. Sometimes we give reluctantly, so we're holding on, well, can I really give, is it okay? Sometimes we give expecting something in return. Sometimes we give because we want to be seen a certain way. So rather than like, instead of the monk who, didn't care if I saw him as he walked away from giving me the cookies and the apple, it's like, you know, you put the cookies and apples there and then you stand, wait, make sure that you know, you wait to put it down until other people in the monastery see you putting it down because, you know, it's important to be seen and recognized for how generous you are, right? So there's identity issues and recognition that's important. And so perfection of generosity involves a kind of letting go of clinging. And so the giving is said to be pure in the sense of it's freely given. It's given without any resistance, any holding back. Just here. And the idea of such free giving is a wonderful ideal, I think. The idea that we get out of the way, the idea that it flows with ease out of us, so that it's not even something, sometimes they say that it's not even something you do, it's something you are. It's almost that natural. Here, take. And I'd like to tie it to the first part of the talk, when the mind has a lot of space, or the heart has a lot of space. It has a lot of room. There's often, in that space, a feeling of sufficiency, a feeling of having enough, a feeling of being that things are good, a feeling of that just sufficiency, so that it's easy to want to give out of that sufficiency. In that space, it's easy to have a kind of deep, a better heartfelt connection to others and what's going on. And so it's easy in that heartfelt connection to give. Here, take. I have enough. Here, you can take. One of the ways I was really touched when I was in Asia about giving, For a while in Burma, I was a monk, and in Japan, I was a monk. And we would sometimes, both countries, would go out sometimes on alms with a little with our bowl. And there were people who obviously were really poor, who would give. In Japan, they'd give coins, and in Burma, you're not allowed to give monks money, so they would put other things in. And you know, it was kind of hard to receive it. In fact, these people are so poor, you know, they shouldn't give it to me. They should keep it. But to feel their delight and the ease and the faith that came with their wanting to give touched me so deeply and made me want to receive it with great appreciation and gratitude. Just like, wow, this is, I wish I could give in that kind of way. So to create, again, this great space to receive, to be empathic, to feel, to take in, to experience the world with an experience of sufficiency, so that, you know, just a in this wonderful ecology of mind and heart, I think in the feeling experience of sufficiency, the best of us comes out. In the experience of insufficiency, I don't have enough, I don't have enough recognition, not enough people like me, I don't have enough this, I don't have enough that, I don't have enough wisdom, I don't have enough generosity. Gil's talking about generosity, and this is like a painful talk because I know I've been very greedy, and I don't have enough this and that. There's a list of different things you can give, and the first thing on the list is give a smile. Isn't that nice? I don't have enough, I can't give anything, nothing to give. Do you have lips? Generosity is a very nice practice, and as a practice, it's not exactly a perfection. Perfection means it's not a practice at all; it's just who we are, and we are that way. But as a practice, it can come from a variety of places. It can come from the inspiration inside that this is a good thing to do. But it can also come from the idea that this practice of generosity is a good way to understand myself. It's a good mirror to the inner ecology of what's going on. So the thought of being generous, the practice of being generous, taking the time to be generous in some different ways, might reveal a lot about yourself. It might reveal that you're not generous, as I discovered in myself at a certain point. You might discover that you're afraid and fear is operating. And so that's what makes it difficult to want to give. It might be that greed is operating. It might be that there's aversion or hate operating. So I'm not going to give to that person, you know, so that we hold back. There can be a lot of issues of self-identification. Ideas of who we are, who we have to be, how we represent ourselves to the world that come into play in this area of generosity. Because generosity is something we usually do, in conventional terms, we do it in relationship to other people. And so we get to start to clarify our relationship to other people through the practice of generosity. And it's great, these lists that begin with generosity, we begin with our relatedness to others and try to establish a healthy relatedness as part of the practice. So perfection of generosity, practicing with generosity, being generous when we don't necessarily want to be generous, not because we should, because we find it an interesting practice to do. We find it interesting what happens when we give when we don't feel like we want to give. We find it interesting what we learn about ourselves. And in doing that, over and over again, it's so useful. When we see the parts of ourselves that are not salutary, we see the parts of ourselves which are not wonderful and that we want to let everyone know how great we are, see the parts of ourselves which are maybe a little unfortunate we have these parts of us, it's so significant, very important, very meaningful, very helpful to be able to hold that in the big mind, to hold that in the spacious mind, the open mind, to give a lot of breathing room to that side of ourselves. We don't have to be claustrophobic with it. We don't have to be caught and give it a lot of authority. We don't have to invest a lot of value in it. We don't have to believe it. We don't have to assume because it's there, that means that I am a certain kind of person. To just kind of keep, again, open, be present, be present. Be with it. But be with it if you can, if this analogy or metaphor of space works for you. Be with lots of space. Big mind, they say. Because that's where I think a profound transformation can happen, when we make space. So, it took me a while to appreciate the next teaching that I came across in the ancient texts. The ancient texts give a list of the different reasons why a person could be generous. And it starts off with the ones which are not so skillful, not so wholesome. And then it goes step by step to different reasons. And then the last reason, which is the highest reason in this list, is to adorn the mind, or adorn the heart, depending how you translate the word. And I thought that's, you know, I don't really like makeup and, you know, and jewelry and adornments and, you know, I don't, it's not like I, you know, I'm a hippie, you know, and back when I was a hippie, we didn't do those things. And then I was a monk and we didn't do those things. And so that's not really part of my world, adornments and all that. So the answer, you know, and also adorning yourself seems so self-conscious and so like trying to make yourself pretty, and it took me a while to relate to it. But how I came to understand it is that what I believe now is the most beautiful thing that you'll ever see in this world is a pure mind or a pure heart. More beautiful than the Grand Canyon or any sunset you can see or any great art. But there's something that resides in yourself, in your heart, in your mind, that is the most beautiful thing that there is in the world. And that as we beautify, as we do this practice, we're kind of beautifying the heart and the mind. The more spacious, the more space, the more big mind we make to hold it all, it becomes like a great, beautiful cathedral. The more claustrophobic we are, it becomes a filthy, dirty elevator. It doesn't even have good air in it. But and so the highest reason is to adorn the mind, to make it beautiful, not for the sake of beauty itself, but because that's where freedom is found, the real taste of freedom, the fullest flavor of freedom. And freedom means a mind that's not clinging, that's not acquisitiveness, not holding on to anything. And that's where we'll find a freedom from our suffering. And that is beautiful, not only because of the freedom we experience, but also because in that beauty, in that sense of sufficiency or fullness or completeness that can be in that big mind, that's where empathy operates the clearest. Our capacity for empathy, for care, for compassion, which is a really wonderful thing. When compassion flows through us because it's who we are, not because we're trying to be compassionate. It's just there. So how do we practice generosity on a retreat like this? I'm pretty confident, I'll say it this way. There were times on retreats that I sat where if someone gave a talk the first day of the retreat about generosity, I would have been annoyed. I would have thought, you know, I'm just so sore and so tired and I have a headache and, you know, it's been so hard day to day and I'm not even sure I want to be here and why did I sign up for this? I forgot now. And I mean, the first day sometimes for me was, you know, it wasn't like the most inspired time. And then someone talks about generosity and like one more thing to think about and do. And like, it's just too much. Please, I think I'll go to bed after this talk. So how do we practice generosity on retreat? Well, certainly, I think just your practice, I very much convinced that even if you're not even intending to be generous, The fact that you're practicing is a generous act. It's generous in the fact that it's a gift. That you show up and sit, that you show up and walk, that you practice through the day, is a gift to all of us that are practicing here. And so just know that your presence is a gift, even if you have a headache. You can care for the community that's here. You care through your work meditation you do, the jobs you have. You care by how you conduct yourself here. Perhaps you walk quietly as a gift, as an act of generosity. Occasionally we've had people on retreat here who are very sensitive, sleep very, very lightly. And so any kind of sound makes it hard for them to sleep. And so, you know, a sound that seems mild to you reverberates for them. So like closing a door is an act of generosity for people. There's standing in line for the meal. It might be generous not to crowd the person in front of you. Step back. Make space for the person. Someone's washing their hands before you. Give them a little bit of space so they have lots of time to wash their hands so they don't feel like they're rushed because you're like right there, like you're poised. I think there's lots of little ways like that to be generous to the community around you here, to care for others, be attentive to them, to know what's going on to a little bit degree that you're caring for other people as well. There is, but I think that one of the important ways to be generous on retreat is to be generous to yourself. Or to practice generosity in some of the way, even some of the ways you talk about practice, or talk to yourself. I believe that it has a very different effect on you and the heart if you pay attention versus if you give attention. And what's this paying attention thing? It's a strange, I don't know, why do we have this expression in English, pay attention. I'm in debt. You know, if it costs to pay, you have to pay for attention, I'm in trouble. But to give attention, then the word give implies generosity, something we give. And so can your attention be an act of generosity? And I believe it is. I think it's one of the very profound things you can give is to give your attention. I have been on ethics committees where I was helping support people who had ethical conflict and were angry and upset in a variety of ways. And one of the things that I learned from doing this is one of the most useful things to do is to really listen to people who are in conflict, listen to people who are angry, to the point where they feel well listened to. And some of the tension and fuel of the conflict decreases dramatically when people feel they've been heard and listened to in the conflict. So it's an act of generosity. We give our attention to someone else by listening and being with them. And it's generous. It helps the situation. Probably all of you have had the experience of someone being present for you, and it helped you because of their presence. They gave their attention to you. So the same way you can give your attention to yourself. And you might use that as an analogy. The experience, if you've had that experience of someone who listened to you well, someone who offered their attention to you, and maybe were non-judgmental in that attention, maybe it's clear that they weren't trying to fix you or get rid of you or judge you. They were just there for you. So if you have that as an example, as a reference point, can you offer that to yourself? Can you just bring attention or presence, a listening awareness, to how you are here and now? This is how it is. And if it's hard in there, if you're struggling, if you're mean, if you're afraid, if you're sad, if you're happy, what's it like to offer non-judgmental awareness to that? What's it like to really listen and be there for it? To give it that space. And space is closely connected to time. Give it time. Being impatient is not very generous. What is it like to give lots of time to your headache? The gift of time to your headache. Have you ever thought of that? That, you know, gotta fix it, this is terrible, it has to go away, enough of this. Gail doesn't understand how difficult these headaches are. Who's he to say anything about it? But to, you know, okay, I have a headache. Let me be generous to the pain. Be generous by letting it be there. Let me be generous by letting it have time to do what it needs to do. Maybe, who knows, I don't know why it has to be there, but maybe it needs to be there. And let me be generous by not attacking it. And let's be generous to myself by not berating myself for somehow, you know, I did something that gave myself a headache. So I think there are ways of being generous to oneself. There's ways of relating to the attention aspect of this practice where we think of it as a gift. So like when we give our attention to the breath as opposed to paying attention to the breath. And it, can we give in a spirit of sufficiency? Give in a sense of here. Here is attention. Breath, my dear breath, here's something for you. I'm here for you. I'll pay attention to you. I'm here. Kind of an open feeling to it. Or if you don't like that, another approach, because being a gracious recipient can be as good as giving a gift. Once I was, someone from Europe was living with us for a while, and she was going to go back to Europe, and so I offered to drive her to the airport. And she said, no, no, it's okay. She was a very shy and timid person. Said, no, I'll take a taxi or something. No. Oh, but, you know, please, I'd like to take you to the airport, can I? No. I think I asked three times. She said, no, and three times you said, okay, I'll back off. But I kind of felt a little bit sad, because I felt that my offer to drive her to the airport was kind of pure. It was kind of a beautiful thing. It was just simple, ordinary, nice thing. And I felt that she had kind of, I don't know exactly how it was, but kind of like she inhibited or stopped or blocked my generosity, my wish to kind of offer something. Sometimes it's really nice to say yes, to receive. Here. It's one of the things I learned at Zen Center in San Francisco. You have all these formal ways of eating there, formal ways where people serve you. And I don't know if it's still the case, but back in the old days, you were never supposed to say no when someone offered you something. So it became kind of a wonderful thing, I thought, to learn how to say, not to say no, say yes, and then in clever ways, get them to give you as little as possible. And I used to have a wheat allergy. So this was before there was much understanding of these things at Zen Center or appreciation for it. And so they would serve a lot of wheat. So they'd have these bowls of food they come and serve you. And so I had to accept it, right? But I knew the consequences of eating the wheat. So I said, okay, please. But I would make all kinds of silent signs. As little as possible, please. So receiving. So instead of giving attention to the breath, what about receiving the breath? What's it? Because sometimes when people relate to the breath in meditation or focusing on anything, use their attention. There's some people who have the pounce on the breath school of meditation, the jerking the mind around school. The mind wanders off, jerk it back, come back. The mind doesn't have to go. The mind doesn't actually go anywhere. So we get caught up in these metaphors. The mind went away. I brought it back. Bring it back. You know, those are just metaphors. The mind doesn't go anywhere. You don't have to bring it back. What you can do instead is you can welcome the breath back in. Instead, you can just welcome reality back into the mind. You notice that you haven't been paying attention. You haven't been, there I go again, how easy it is to say paying attention. You notice you haven't been attentive because you're lost in thought. And in knowing that, you can just say, welcome reality back. Welcome breathing back. Part of being generous is to be a good recipient. Who knows, does your breath need your attention? Or do you need your breath? Who's giving to who? And I found it very meaningful sometimes to sit and meditate and just receive the experiences that I have. Receive the breath. And this spacious way of being, the open, big mind, I think it comes more easily with the idea of receiving, making space for. And I think it's a very, very generous thing to ourselves to make a lot of space for ourselves, to let us be who we are. I know that for me, my track, if I go look back over my life, my track record of success in understanding what I need and what I'm supposed to be doing, what should happen, has been relatively poor. But you know who knows better than you what you need? For me, being a Buddhist kind of guy, I like to say the Dharma knows better than me. The practice knows better than me. There's an inner wisdom, inner knowing that knows what needs to come out, knows what needs to happen, knows what needs to go on. And so I've learned that to trust this, to trust the Dharma, trust the practice, and to make space, be generous. Who knows what needs to happen next? Maybe what needs to happen is the fury of a lifetime needs to bubble up as you're sitting here. Rage needs to bubble up. So then you make space for that. Remember, we're sitting still, so you're safe. You're not going to punch anyone out because you're committed to not moving. And so you let the rage come. Who knows what's supposed to happen? Maybe if you just make space for it and feel it and welcome it and be generous to that, let yourself be that way. The Dharma knows what needs to happen. The practice knows. Something will unfold and move. If we practice non-clinging to it, non-resistance to it, something deep, the inner wisdom will move through us. So the practice is a practice, I think the practice of presence, practice of mindfulness, the practice of attention that we do here is a very generous thing. Because where else in the world is it safe and reasonable to sit and allow yourself to be exactly who you are? In most settings in the world, cultures, societies, institutions, communities, you have to kind of a little bit modify yourself and change who you are a little bit. And here when you sit and meditate, at least, maybe with your eyes closed or not, here, just let it be. Open to it. Keep opening. Be generous. Make space for this too. So I'll end with a little piece of advice. If something happens here at the retreat for you, anything at all, that is difficult for you, it doesn't have to be difficulty, it could be anything at all, but if you do it too often, you'd be doing all the time, but it is difficult for you. If you have a wristwatch, or if you can pretend you have one, look at your watch and say, right on time. Right on time. It arrived right on time. And that's much better than, oh no, this shouldn't be happening, it's not supposed to be happening, it shouldn't be this way, right on time. So you're sitting, and one of the sittings here, maybe you're concentrated, and it's just so nice, finally your mind is a little bit still, and I got a maid. It'll be, this rest of the retreats can be a breeze. And you come back to the next sitting, and your mind's like crazy. It's like a wild horse. Right on time. Because maybe that's what's supposed to happen. You don't know. It could be that something, because you had that quiet sitting, it opened a door in your mind for something important to happen next. That comes with this wild energy that needs to happen for a while. Maybe. You don't know. You don't know. But you can trust the instinct to be generous here in this practice. The instinct to open and be present. Allow it to be there. Keeping present. Here. Here for this. Make space for it. Make time for it. Be generous. The perfection of generosity. So the custom here in these retreats is generally is to, at the end of a talk, is to kind of regather ourselves back in and take up just a minute or so and go back into the meditation.